Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is one of the most dynamic people working on behalf of Israel today, Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, the founder and president of the Israel Project. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I had a very interesting email exchange this week with a state senator from South Dakota named Stanford Adelstein. The email read, "Dear Rabbi Kohan, in searching for the right shofar sounds for a funeral, I found your sermon on the shofar. Today, my special friend of more than 40 years and 8 years our governor, Bill Janklow, died. His father and two of his brothers are Jewish. His family asked if I would blow the shofar at the funeral. Since the one brother is a member of our little congregation, and his wife remembered a TV clip of my sounding the shofar as a call to worship for the installation of South Dakota's ELCA bishop, also a very special friend who will be conducting the funeral. Long, long ago, I was a professional French horn player, and I have blown my collection of shofars for about 50 years for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. The question, what should the sound be? For a bishop's installation, easy. Tekiyas and truas, a little octave jumping, because that is triumphant and joyful. My wife asked if I could even do this, but I'm sort of running out of tears. I saw a taps on YouTube on shofar, and I even have a shofar I can do that on, but not appropriate, I think. What should I play? Long tekiyas, maybe reversed from high notes going down? You've obviously given shofar blowing a lot of thought. What do you feel or think?" Well, I had heard of Bill Janklow, the former four-term governor of South Dakota, a colorful and influential politician, arguably the most prominent one in that state. He also served as a congressman, I think, but I didn't know that Bill Janklow had Jewish ancestors. I mean, in South Dakota and all. In any case, it raised a very interesting Jewish question, the tradition of the Shela Tshuva process of Talmudic responsa, the question and answer system that has been used for questions of Jewish law and custom for close to 1,500 years. When you're not sure what to do in a situation, particularly a new situation that you believe has never occurred or hasn't occurred much, you write and ask a rabbi who has some experience, knowledge, and perhaps authority in that particular area. As I noted in the sermon that the senator found online, I have blown shofar, the ram's horn used to herald the Jewish New Year on Rosh Hashanah, in many different venues over the years, including the ordination of an Episcopal priest and at the funeral for a Roman Catholic bishop. So, I actually had an answer, and I emailed back. "Dear Senator Adelstein, what an interesting inquiry. My condolences on the death of Governor Janklow. I had no idea he had Jewish connections. I would suggest that the best set of calls for a funeral would be a simple Tekiah Shvarim Trua Tekiah Gedola, holding the final Tekiah Gedola as long as possible. If you can fade it out at the end, no small trick with a shofar without a gliss in it, it would make a suitable farewell. There is something stately, simple, and powerful in the traditional sequence. We use it at the conclusion of Rosh Hashanah, and of course the Tekiah Gedola ends Yom Kippur. A fitting farewell to an old friend. May that ceremony and the resonance of the shofar bring consolation and comfort to his family and old friends." Well, this little exchange reminded me of the time when I served as a student rabbi, not quite in South Dakota, but in nearby Billings, Montana, back in 1993 to 94. During that year, I actually conducted a baby naming for a South Dakota family. They drove and met me in Miles City, Montana, which required, as I recall, a two-hour drive for each of us in each direction. Jews are spread pretty thinly in that part of the world. Actually, people are spread pretty thinly in that part of the world. When you do meet somebody Jewish in that neck of the woods, they inevitably know everybody else Jewish in the whole region. Which reminded me of a story from my student days traveling back and forth to Billings. I was in rabbinical school at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati studying to become a rabbi. The way it works for far-flung small congregations scattered about the United States is that they can't afford to hire a full-time rabbi, so they pay to fly out a rabbinical student from the Reform Seminary, HUC, usually every other week, to lead services and run religious school and do a little adult education and anything else that comes up. The student flies in on Friday and then flies back to Cincinnati or L.A. on the following Monday. My former bar mitzvah kid from my own congregation, Temple Emmanuel of Tucson, Arizona, Jay Levine, currently serves a congregation in Grand Junction, Colorado, in just this way. Anyway, that year, 1993 to 94, I used to fly out to Billings, Montana every other week from Cincinnati. It was a fascinating and a highly educational year in many, many ways, but one thing it definitely required was a whole lot of travel, since the cities are about 1,500 miles apart. Cincinnati was a Delta Airlines hub, it still is, I believe, and I would fly nonstop to Salt Lake City, lay over a couple of hours, and then take a short commuter flight to Billings. As a rabbinical student and student rabbi, I always had a lot of work to do on those trips, and the flights were a good place to do it. I'd write sermons or prep classes I was teaching, and on the way back home, I would read and study for classes and tests or do rough drafts of papers I was writing. There was one problem, however. Salt Lake City, as you may be aware, is home to many Mormons, members of the Church of the Latter-day Saints, and they are among the nicest people I have ever met. I don't know if that includes Mitt Romney or not. I didn't meet him. But anyway, Mormons can also be among the chattiest people. Since they don't drink on flights or ever, they have plenty of time to talk, are very polite, and are very interested in religion. So inevitably, on my way in or out of Salt Lake City, I would be situated in my plane seat with books and articles, and then someone would plop down next to me, see what I was reading. Maybe it was the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, or Buber's I and Thou, or the Mishnah, or some other Jewish text, and ask me what I did. And as soon as I said I was a rabbinical student, they would warm immediately to the conversation. Usually it would start, "I so admire your people." And then there'd be a series of questions about the Torah, Jewish history, the Talmud, and so on. One bright-eyed, pleasant, eager query after another. The theological conversations were very interesting, but pretty soon I'd realize I wasn't getting any work done on the whole precious flight. Well, so on one trip from Salt Lake City, I absolutely had to finish writing a talk I was giving at a wedding, and I had a 3-hour flight to do so before I got home. And so when I sat down next to a window with an empty seat next to me, I was delighted. Unfortunately, just before takeoff, they moved another passenger into that precious empty seat, and I just knew what was coming. So this time, when the polite question came from the man, "So, what do you do?" I lied. And I answered with the greatest conversation stopper of all. I said, "I'm a computer engineer." Naturally, that completely ended all possibility of further conversation, because what do you say to a computer engineer? Relieved, I worked hard on my talk and finished it just as we were landing. But I felt badly. I had misled the poor guy and left him with no one to talk to over the course of the entire flight. So, in an effort to make amends and soothe my guilty conscience, I gently inquired of my seatmate just what it was that he did, and he answered he was a jeweler in Ogden, Utah. "Well, what brings you here?" I asked. "Oh," he said, "I'm the president of my synagogue in Ogden. I'm here to interview rabbinical students to be our new student rabbi." To which I said, "How nice." You see, there are two lessons here. First, it's never a good idea to lie, and God can zap you unexpectedly and sometimes right away. And second, there really are Jews everywhere, even in small towns and prairie states you don't normally associate with us. And we really are all connected, sometimes against our will. So, our condolences go out to the great state of South Dakota on the death of its long-term governor and to its small but important Jewish community. And may that state senator's shofar continue to sound not only in mourning, but also in joy. Play us in this morning on that theme. Here's an unseasonal but appropriate rendition of Tekaba Shofar, Sound the Great Shofar of Freedom, by my dad, Rabbi Baruch Kohan. Tekaba Shofar Gadol Leherutenu Mesames Mesames Lekabes Galuyotenu Bekamtenu Yahad Amen.
Teka, teka, bishofar gadol, lecheiru tenu, vesa, vesanes, lekabet, galu yotenu, vekabetzeinu yachad, mehera, mehera,
mehar batan fotaret, leyatzeinu.
Teka, Kabetzeinu yachad mehera mehera
Me'ar batan fotaret leyatzeinu Teka
Teka
Teka bishofar gadol
Teka bishofar gadol
Teka
bishofar gadol
Teka bishofar
gadol
Teka bishofar gadol
Teka bishofar
That was Teka B'Shofar from my dad, Baruch Kohan. While we always associate the shofar with the Jewish High Holy Days, the truth is that that particular prayer, Teka B'Shofar, is actually from the weekday Amidah, the standing private prayers recited three times daily by observant Orthodox and conservative Jews, and even some Reform Jews. Its text applies year-round. Sound the great shofar of freedom, and raise high the banner to gather all exiles from the corners of the earth. A great message every day, not just on Rosh Hashanah. Our guest this morning, Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, knows all about great messages. She is the founder and president of the cutting-edge Israel advocacy organization, the Israel Project, and, by the reckoning of the Forward magazine, the second most influential Jew in the world last year. Find out why when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. The other day when I was struggling to come up with an idea for a new Mama's commercial, I overheard a family talking about their son's high school football team. My mind raced back to 1964 in Long Island, New York, when my brother Vinny played football for the West Hempstead High School Rams. Vinny was a great player, and of course the whole Spina family went to each and every game. After the games, we'd often come home and Mom would make one of her delicious Sicilian-style pizzas. My mouth still waters when I think of the great rich-tasting tomato sauce and creamy fresh mozzarella cheese sitting on top of her warm, homemade semolina dough. It's the exact great taste we put into the pizzas we make every day at our mama's restaurants in Tucson. You know, I love thinking about football and the good old days in New York. I just wish all this reminiscing would help me come up with a good idea for a new radio commercial. Repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Ready to move your child to an outstanding private school? Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA, is accepting a limited number of enrollments for January 2012, mid-year. THA's kindergarten through 8th grade integrated curriculum centers on rigorous academics infused with Jewish values and ethics, thereby providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes even, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. THA graduates capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter high school, ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. A great education is more affordable than you think, and the best education comes from THA. Space is limited. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi. She's the president of the Israel Project and has been named one of the most important and influential people affecting the general opinion about Israel in American media and around the world. Good morning.
How are you?
I'm well. Jennifer, Tell me how the Israel Project got started and what motivated you to get into this.
Well, I was clearly motivated by how Israel was taking quite a beating in the international press. I've been to Israel several times, and I knew what Israel was all about. And when you look at it in the media, you see something totally different than what it actually is. I discovered that nobody was out there educating reporters to let them know what the true facts are about Israel in the Middle East. And so we really started to fill that gap, and we're now filling additional gaps in terms of educating ambassadors, particularly the ambassadors that are stationed in Israel. Most people don't realize that there are 60 embassies in Israel and that nobody previously was educating them on the facts about Israel. So literally, you had these ambassadors who would go from their villas in Herzliya to their offices by chauffeur in Tel Aviv, and they wouldn't see the country. They didn't understand, for example, that Jerusalem isn't just like a pizza that you can divide in half with pepperoni on one side and anchovies on the other, that what? It's really a mosaic.
I'm sorry, nobody in Jerusalem except the Christians eats pepperoni, not the Muslims and not the Jews. You have to think of a different analogy there.
You are so right. You are so right. But you cannot divide Jerusalem simply. It just doesn't work. The city would not function. But you had these incredibly important diplomats who didn't understand that, you know, the Kotel, the holiest of holies, is on the quote-unquote wrong side of the 67 lines. They didn't understand that, you know, in East Jerusalem is Har Tzafim, Hebrew University, this amazing Israeli campus. They didn't know that Hadassah is on the quote-unquote wrong side. They just didn't understand the integrated nature of the city. And when they come and they tour it and they see it with their own eyes, these are ambassadors who literally live only an hour away over in Herzliya, still hadn't seen the facts on the ground from anything other than tours by anti-Israel groups that were filling them with utter nonsense. So we're just there trying to fill some gaps.
So, you know, Israel has long had a kind of deficit in hasbara, in public relations and media. You're filling a gap that a lot of people think the Israeli government should be supplying. Do you see it that way?
Well, government is supposed to fill a lot of gaps, but the government can't do everything. You know, even in America, we see that there's a lot of things that we'd like to see our leaders doing, but private sector and nonprofits can play a very important educational role.
We will talk much more this morning with Jennifer Lazo-Mizrahi when we come back on Too Jewish and hear a lot about what Israel's doing and what the Israel Project's all about.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grand, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org. Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Trip to Israel with Rabbi Sam Kohan is set May 30th to June 10th of 2012. If you're interested in going with me on this fantastic journey to Israel, email twojewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. Sign-ups are due in February. When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with the great restaurateur Janos Wilder of Janos Restaurant at the J Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Now, this is a really obvious question to ask, but what's cooking at Janos?
Greatness, wonderful food, wonderful flavors, great experiences, beautiful atmosphere, terrific views. That's about it.
You know, I have to say, it is really one of the most magnificent restaurant experiences you can have, not just in the Southwest, but in the world.
Well, thanks, Rabbi. You know, we have three restaurants now, but Janos is the flagship. That's where we put everything into it. All the elegance, all of the love, all of the caring. That's the peak of what we do.
So for a very special night, or just because you want to have a spectacular meal, how can they get in touch with you?
Just give us a call, 615-6100. Go to our website, www.janos.com. We'll be happy to see you.
That's janos.com. Thanks, Janos.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We have been talking about tolerance and how we learn tolerance and the teaching of tolerance. You mentioned a great off-mic Yitzchak Basheva Singer story about the mass. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, there's this great story, and unfortunately, I don't even remember the name of the story, but it was about the conflict between Hasidim and Misnagdim in one family where the son-in-law was a Hasid and his wife had a father who was a strong Misnagd, and the father had a terrible temper. And he tried all kinds of things to cure his temper, and nothing would work, and he was at risk of losing his wife, his daughter, all his friends, and whatever. And finally, the son-in-law convinced him to go spend a Shabbos with a Hasidic Rebbe, who said, basically, if you can't be the kind and patient man, act the kind and patient. Pretend. Don't yell. When you want to get angry, smile. Eventually, we become what we act like. And this is also the basis of a lot of Jewish laws, as you pointed out off mic. The mitzvot are act in a certain way, and eventually your feelings will follow. Na'aseh v'nishma. Right. And it's the rationale behind many of the Jewish commandments that otherwise make no sense about, you know, mixing certain fabrics or mixing milk and, I mean, all kinds of things. If we act in a certain way, we become that way. So then the question is, well, how do you take that into tolerance education? Do you first try to teach people to be nice, to have nice feelings, to be mellow, to love their fellow human being? Or do you try to change their behavior? And I think the history of legislation in our country and legislative change going back to first big change in this area was integrating the armed forces, which used to have separate units. We said, we don't care how you feel. You're going to serve together and you're going to live together. And then there was a series of laws in the 50s and more in the 60s and even more in the 70s, basically making illegal wider and wider forms of discrimination against people of color. And the theory was that the good feelings and the real tolerance would follow. Now, then there's a whole other question, a semantic question of, is tolerance the right word? Because some people would say you tolerate something which is by definition bad, like right. You tolerate a medicine. like, how good is your tolerance for the side effects of chemotherapy? Okay, so that by using the word tolerance, we imply that something is bad or undesirable. But, you know, for want of a better word, we could say acceptance, we could say inclusion.
Yeah, I mean, they struggle with that in every civic group I've ever gotten involved with. When they start talking about tolerance, somebody says, oh, tolerance is a limited concept, we want something more. But at the very least, if we had tolerance, we could argue about the semantics all we wanted. At least we'd have it on the ground, as
right.
it were.
It's a first step, and it's a necessary right. first step. And
right.
what makes this such an urgent topic is, so we think, for example, okay, we've pretty much eliminated the danger of violent anti-Semitism in this country, so we're safe. I mean, that's, Jews feel that way about living in the United States, and they may be right. But what about all the other groups all over the world? You know, the wrong kind of Christian in the certain Christian country, or the wrong kind of Muslim, or the person with the wrong gender orientation or sexual orientation in a country which criminalizes even gay feelings, never mind gay actions. I mean, there's all kinds of people all over the world who are being killed every day because of a lack of basic tolerance and recognizing the universal humanity that lies in each of us.
And, you know, of course, that goes back to the basic Jewish notion, B'Tselem Elohim, each individual, every human being is created in the image of God. Central Jewish idea. So came back around. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Four Jewish brothers left home for college. They became successful doctors and lawyers and prospered. Some years later, they chatted after having dinner. When their mother had an important birthday, they discussed the gifts they were able to give their elderly mama, who lives so far away. The first son, Milton, said, "I had a big house built for mama." The second son, Menachem, said, "I had a $100,000 theater built in the house." The third son, Marvin, said, "I had my Mercedes dealer deliver her a brand new Mercedes with a chauffeur." And the fourth son, Melvin, said, "Listen to this. You know how Mama loved reading Torah? Well, you know she can't read anymore because of her eyesight. So I met this rabbi. He told me about a parrot that can recite the whole Torah. It took 20 rabbis, 12 years to teach this parrot. I had to pledge to contribute $100,000 a year for 20 years to the temple, but let me tell you, it was worth it. All Mama has to do is name a sedra or a chapter or a verse, and the parrot will recite it." Well, the brothers were all very impressed. After her birthday, Mom sent thank you notes. She wrote, "Milton, the house you built is so huge, I live only in one room, and yet I have to clean the whole house. Thanks anyway. Menachem, you gave me an expensive theater with surround sound. It can hold 50 people, but I'm so old now that all my friends are dead. I've lost my hearing and I'm nearly blind. I'll never use it. But thank you for the gesture. Marvin, I am too old to travel. I stay home, my groceries are delivered, I never use the Mercedes, and the driver you hired is a Nazi. But the thought was good. Thanks. But dearest Melvin, you were the only son to have the good sense to give a little thought to your gift. The chicken was delicious." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and enjoy the chicken. This week, our people finally gets out of Egypt. Or to be more accurate, we chant the Torah portion of Bo, which includes the description of the actual exodus from Egyptian slavery and the establishment of the rites and rituals of the observance of the Passover. The build-up to this week's Parsha has been steady and dramatic. Plague follows plague, 10 of them, of course, rising in severity as the one God overcomes the long roster of Egyptian gods and idols and frees the people of Israel from their long night of oppression and slavery. Finally, here in Bo, our ancestors become a truly free people. Well, since we are now free, you might expect us to immediately cast off the memory of oppression and enslavement and move on to new and better things, to reject our history of degradation. Oddly, God, through Moses, now commands us to do the opposite, to remember the slavery and how we were freed only by God's great acts. From this point on, we were reminded repeatedly in the Torah to remember those in our own society who are oppressed, to help them. Because, after all, we ourselves were slaves in the land of Egypt. You were strangers in a strange land, we tell ourselves. Help the strangers in your land. The message is powerful. We are to recall the fact of our own oppression so that we will identify with those in our own world who need our help. The Sedra of Bo teaches us that we must seek always to redeem the world through our own action. Our connection is with the lowly. Our efforts to heal the world come from the knowledge that we ourselves have come up from exactly that background. It's a powerful lesson in humility that leads directly to charity, tzedakah, and the promulgation of righteousness in our world. When we come back on To Jewish, our guest, Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, the founder of the highly successful PR innovation, The Israel Project, will tell us what issues she's advocating for now and how she does it all when we return in a few moments here on To Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Attention, Arizona taxpayers. You can help send children to our community's Jewish schools without it costing you a dime. Direct your tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. State of Arizona allows taxpayers to receive dollar-for-dollar tax credit, not deduction, for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations. This allows them to provide scholarship for kids in K-12 at qualified private schools. JETCO provides a quality Jewish education to children in need at Temple Emmanuel Kindergarten, Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten, the Tucson Jewish Community Center Kindergarten, and the Tucson Hebrew Academy, THA. If you pay Arizona state taxes and make your donation today before December 31st, you'll receive 100% tax credit on your Arizona state income tax. Your contributions last year helped more than 100 children receive the financial aid they needed to get a Jewish education. Join over 750 supporters who gave up to $1,000 per couple, $500 per individual as a tax credit, and got it all back in the form of reduced or refunded state income taxes. To direct your tax dollars to Jewish education today, please call 647-8442. You can do it on your credit card, 647-8442, or visit JETCO on the web at www.jetco.org. Help give the gift of Jewish education.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
There are more American Jews than we previously thought. More than 6 million Jews are living in the U.S., according to two independent studies released last week. The studies, using completely different methodology, discovered between 6.4 million and 6.6 million U.S. Jews, about 1.8% of the U.S. population. That figure is 20% higher than the 5.2 million reported by the 2000 National Jewish Population Survey, sponsored by the Jewish Federations of North America, a study that was found to be faulty and is said to have undercounted the Jewish population. The two studies, one by Ira Sheskin, a human geographer at the University of Miami and a former guest of Too Jewish, working with Arnold Deshevsky, a sociologist at the University of Connecticut for the North American Jewish Databank, reported that the correct figure is 6,588,000, nearly 6.6 million. Another study by Leonard Sachs, a Brandeis University sociologist and another former guest of Too Jewish, puts the number of U.S. Jews at 6.4 million. The studies are important indicators of the size of the U.S. Jewish population because the once-a-decade National Jewish Population Survey was not conducted after the Jewish Federations declined to underwrite the survey this last year. Well, it's good that there's more of us than we thought, isn't it? Last week, President Obama announced that Jack Lew, his director of the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB's cabinet-level position, is moving across to another seat. He will replace William Daley as White House Chief of Staff. Lew, who is 56, was chosen for his long years in government, his reputation as a skilled multitasker. He was the top budget cruncher for Bill Clinton before reprising the job for Obama. Since Dennis Ross, Obama's top Iran advisor, announced his departure late last year, Jewish community officials wondered who was left to call in a White House that has lost several Jewish top officials over the last year, including Rahm Emanuel, another previous chief of staff. Lew, an Orthodox Jew, is close to the Jewish community in Washington and is a go-to person for Jewish events in the Capitol. Lew interests Jewish audiences because of how he balances the 24/7 demands of being a top government official with a 24/6 Sabbath observant lifestyle, as Joe Lieberman used to say. One incident involves a Shabbat call Lew received from then-President Clinton when he was serving in his administration. Lew came home from shul and the phone rang. As was his practice, he waited until the answering machine clicked on to see if it was urgent enough to pick up. As it happened, it was a White House staffer telling him to ignore an earlier message from Clinton, who had been phoning from overseas and forgot that in Washington it was still Shabbat. The matter was not urgent enough to interrupt Lew's observance, Clinton told the staffer. Going out of his way to keep Lew from breaking the Sabbath was a sign of the respect that President Clinton had for his observance, Lew likes to tell people. Another favorite line during the 1990s, when he lived in Washington, Lew's family is now based in New York, was an exchange with clergy at Beth Shalom, a synagogue in Potomac, Maryland. The rabbi jokingly suggested that Lew might want to run for shul treasurer. Lew answered that directing the OMB was complex enough. He didn't need the extra trouble that came with being a shul treasurer. Thank you very much. In other news, Israel's Defense Minister Ehud Barak said last week that any decision about an Israeli attack on Iran was very far off. Barak, another former guest of Too Jewish, was speaking just before the visit of U.S. Armed Forces Chief General Martin Dempsey that has triggered speculation that Washington will press Israel to delay action against Tehran's nuclear program. Barak's remarks suggest that Iran, which denies trying to make a nuclear bomb while defying international censure of its secret uranium enrichment and missile projects, has not yet advanced past what Israel might deem a critical threshold. Asked if the U.S. has asked Israel to tell them before any assault against Iran, Barak said, "We haven't made any decision to do this. The entire thing is very far off." Barak also hinted that Israel, presumed to have the only nuclear warheads in the region, was coordinating with Washington its plans to deal with Tehran's nuclear project. "I don't think our ties with the U.S. are such that they have no idea what we're talking about," he said, somewhat obliquely, but we get the idea. Asked for an assessment on how long it would take Iran to build a nuclear warhead were it to make that decision, Barak said, "It's not a matter of many years. There are those who say a year or a year and a half. It doesn't make much difference. I don't want to relate it to weaponization as though tomorrow it will happen," he said. Well, I guess that's sort of good news. In any case, that is the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi. She's the head of the Israel Project, which explains Israel not only to media all around the world, but interestingly, to ambassadors in Israel who've never seen the country. There are many, many organizations out there advocating for Israel, from lobbying groups like AIPAC to Jewish Community Relations Council, the national and the local versions, which try to get the story about Israel out. What are they missing? What are they not successfully doing?
Look, our target market is reporters, who are the lens through which the world sees Israel, and ambassadors who make critical decisions who need to understand Israel and the facts. I met with an ambassador from a UN Security Council country. This is a country that votes on Israel constantly, whether it's on the Goldstone Report or it's on what's happening in Gaza, whether it's on housing projects in East Jerusalem, constantly involved in Israel issues. He had never seen a map of Israel, didn't know who Israel's neighbors were. It was stunning to me. I was very grateful that he was willing to admit to me that he didn't have a knowledge base. He had just been going along with the Arab League in terms of voting pattern. Very pleased when he said that they would send a senior diplomat to Israel to see the facts. And educating these folks in what the facts are, it can make all the difference in the world.
You know, there aren't that many countries on the Security Council. We could probably speculate and figure out which representative it was. But if it's at that level, it must be really widespread. Your group has grown very quickly at a time when many nonprofits are contracting or struggling even to survive. Do you see yourself moving into other areas or just continuing to focus on this particular target market, both government personnel and specifically reporters?
We want to go much deeper in the areas where it went. You know, the New York Times, when I get up in the morning, rarely says what I'd like it to say. I mean, it's not talking about the issues about Israel in a way that makes me feel good about their coverage. Their op-ed selection in particular, I think, is tragic. So, we have a lot of work to do at the New York Times. We have a lot of work to do to get some of the images on TV. I know that right now that 60 Minutes is working on yet another special section on Israel. Well, the last one they did on Jerusalem was fairly a hatchet job. So we have a long way to go before I will say we want to take on anything else. We have a big job in front of us. That's trying to get the people who watch the TV, who watch, read newspapers, to see Israel in an accurate light. Now, I'm not going to say that Israel is always correct, that they're perfect. They make plenty of mistakes over in Jerusalem, just like America makes mistakes and it has it deals with its policy. But on balance, it's an amazing country. And if you put out the facts in a truthful manner, people become much, much more supportive of Israel and much, much more supportive of policies, i.e. sanctions on Iran, that can help make Israel safer.
Reporters might be the most skeptical group of human beings in the world. What's special about the way that you would approach someone whose job is, of course, they have to crank out stories, they have to talk, you know, they have to produce product, but they start, first of all, from, as you said, a kind of deficit of information. They've received a lot of sort of skewed approaches and information from the general media to this point. How do you convince a naturally skeptical person like a reporter to listen to what you have to say?
Well, first of all, 60% of reporters who cover Israel self-report in polling that they've never been there. So that's a critical moment. You know, when you have something like a flotilla issue and it comes across the news wires and then all of a sudden you've got a TV anchor person talking about it when they've never been to Israel, highly problematic. So we try and focus on filling the gaps. We have all these reporters that we can on email distribution list so that, for example, when the flotilla incident happened and it was widely, widely reported that Israel had killed 9 humanitarian workers, as if these were 80-year-old Red Cross volunteers with their Band-Aids and their cupcakes in their hands. It wasn't. When they were able to see the footage of what actually happened on the ship, when they were able to see the jihadi videos that were made by some of the people who got on the ship in the first place, it really changed their minds. Now, did the IDF do a perfect job on the ship? I mean, I think
clearly
the IDF
not,
has
right.
shed that it's felt that they could have done a better job on the ship and that, you know, there was their own internal investigation and they wished that they had handled it a little differently and a little bit better. But the fact is that these were not 80-year-old grandmothers holding Band-Aids and cupcakes. These were people who, in many cases, wanted to be martyrs. In many cases wanted to be involved in jihad, and they physically attacked with big metal poles hitting the IDF people over the head. So it was a very different scenario. And once the reporters got emailed the tape and they were able to see the footage, they were able to say, hey, wait a minute, the coverage we've been giving for a couple hours on CNN and MSNBC and Fox, I wasn't accurate. Now here's the real picture. Let's put that picture on TV. So that's a big way we can do it, is just quickly using email to get out facts. The other thing we do is for the reporters in Israel, and there's a huge number of very seasoned journalists in Israel trying to get them access to newsmakers, whether it's a press conference with Yaalon, who's the Vice Prime Minister of Israel, or with the Prime Minister of Israel. We want to try and make sure that they have access to these leaders so they can ask the questions they need to get the story right.
You know, I think that Bibi Netanyahu is probably the smoothest speaker in English of any Israeli prime minister in history. He is certainly media savvy, and yet his media presentation in the United States has been less than laudatory. Is it a fair presentation?
I actually think he's done a very good job frequently. The speech that he gave to the joint session of Congress, which he got multiple standing ovations at, was a fabulous speech. Tom Friedman from the New York Times wrote a column suggesting that he got standing ovations because the elected officials were bought and paid for by the pro-Israel lobby. Well, that was utter nonsense. The fact is that Americans are pro-Israel, not just American Jews, but Americans overall. There's been a lot made of, you know, why are these Republican candidates in the primary saying all these pro-Israel things? It's all about getting Jewish votes. That's nonsense. The early caucus and primary states are New Hampshire, Iowa, and South Carolina. How many Jews live in New Hampshire, Iowa, and South Carolina? Hey, almost none.
I was the rabbi in Spartanburg, South Carolina for 4 years, and there we had about 800 Jews, I think.
800 Jews in the whole state
of South Carolina. Not more,
a handful of Jews compared to evangelicals. About evangelicals. It's all about Americans who are non-Jews who care deeply, deeply, deeply about Israel.
In your efforts to get the news out and get the word out, you've found a way of balancing it so you aren't seen as a pro-Israel lobbying group. That's a hard balance, isn't it, sometimes?
Well, first of all, it helps that we just don't lobby. We're not a lobby group. We're an educational group.
Let me rephrase that.
APAC is a lobby group.
Let me rephrase it. You haven't been stamped as, oh, okay, this is just a total Israel sell job. And look, I'm totally positive on Israel. I'm a strong Zionist. But I have to recognize that if you're talking to people who are not convinced that, you know, what Israel is doing is right, it's really hard to convince them if they identify you that way from the start. How do you find a way to talk to people who are not necessarily inclined to listen?
Well, the person who controls all of our editorial content is Alan Elsner. Alan joined us a year and a half ago from Reuters, where he was their chief diplomatic correspondent previously. He also served as their Jerusalem bureau chief. He also served as their chief political correspondent in charge of two presidential campaigns, all of the Reuters coverage. So this is a guy who's a real straight shooter, and he just presents facts. The fact is that the facts are on Israel's side. So if you put it out in a clean, straightforward, factual manner, people are going to be much more supportive of Israel. So we don't hide from things that are difficult. We put it out there, and then sometimes we put it in context. We might say, well, you know, you might not like that Israel did this, but let me tell you why they did this. For example, you know, that quote-unquote, you know, attack that Israel did in Gaza wasn't that Israel wanted to go out and kill Palestinians. It was that Israel left Gaza in 2005 with hopes of peace. And what has it gotten in return? Rocket after rocket after rocket. Israel has a right to defend its citizens. Let's put this thing in context.
The flotilla incident was a very interesting experience because they planned a whole other flotilla last summer. And of course, the IDF and various foreign diplomatic channels in Israel were now ready for it and responded effectively, and it never happened. What's the next big effort that you see coming that's going to require a more elaborate approach to sort of being prepared in the area of the kind of explanations that you do?
Clearly, it's the issue of Iran. Iran is getting very close to nuclear weapons capability, very, very close. You know, perhaps we'll get lucky and the changes in North Korea will mean that they're less involved in helping Iran. But Iran is very, very far down this path. And we don't have a lot of time. There are very, very serious sanctions that are about to become law in Washington, these new central bank, you know, sanctions that are coming down the pike. But all options are on the table, and some of those options might be used, and they might not be so pretty. And so being ready, no matter what happens, to really stand up and say this is why it's in the world's best interest to do A, B, and C to be sure Iran doesn't get nuclear weapons, that's very important.
The Iranian question, you know, brings up some other issues. Israel has undoubtedly had some influence in, let's say, terminating the careers of certain Iranian scientists. that story hasn't really come out or hit the press in America or even Europe the way you might have expected it to.
Well, Israel has certainly never taken credit for that. It was accused of ending prematurely the careers of some nuclear and rocket scientists, but it's not proven that they're the ones who did it. And there's a lot of controversy over that issue. But, you know, nobody has been attacking Israel for it, even though they were accused for it, because the world recognizes that it's in the world's best interest to make sure that these nuclear devices are never completed, because nobody wants, few people want Ahmadinejad to have the capability to have a nuclear military weapon.
Interesting. Europe is a tougher market than America by far, I think, in terms of the media and in terms of public opinion. How do you work there? What's your involvement or influence there?
When we work in Europe, we partner with local groups that are, you know, Jewish and pro-Israel groups that are there, because you don't want to be the ugly American walking in and telling people how to do their job. You want to be their partner. You want to be their resource. We have many Europeans that are on our staff. I think we have, between our UK, German, and French citizens on our staff, we probably have maybe 20 different individuals who carry an EU or a British passport. So, really integrating. We work in a number of different languages, including, by the way, Russian and Mandarin. And having people who are really, really fluent in those languages, who really understand the culture, that's really, really the key.
So you were very prominent on the Forward 50 list. How did your family feel about that?
Well, I was very honored. It was the third time that I was on the list. This time I was number two, and Gabby Giffords was number one.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, people in your part of the country have a lot of reason to be very proud of her.
Right.
And her contribution to, I think, putting hope on the planet. When she came back to Washington to cast a vote, I think in a very nonpartisan sort of way, I thought it really was very inspiring for a lot of people.
So you didn't answer the question. Gabby's a friend, been on the show a number of times, and we're thrilled that she's continuing to recover. But still, how does it feel? Number two, the second most influential Jew in America last year.
It's nice, but you know, one year you're up, one year you're down. What feels nice is when Israel's safer. So, you know, and to that end, I actually have to run because I'm about to meet with Ambassador Oren, and at the end of the day, it's all about how do you make Israel and our global Jewish family safer. We play our little role. Our role is educating reporters and educating diplomats. And, you know, every bit of help that we can get is fabulous. And let me just give a pitch, if I might, that we invite people to work with us by listening to 1-800 calls, 1-800 number calls with Israeli officials like Michael Oren, Israel's ambassador, and many others. And if they want to be involved with us, they can just go to www.theisraelproject.org. And they can sign up for our free emails and to be involved in the call. We have 140,000 activists involved with us. It's free. And I hope many of your listeners will get involved with us, because the power of our organization is the power of Americans who care and are willing to stand up and make a difference.
It's fantastic. The IsraelProject.org?
Yes.
Great. The IsraelProject.org. I want to thank Jennifer Lazlo Mizrahi for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Say hi to Ambassador Oren, a former guest of Too Jewish as well.
Fabulous. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock when our guest will be Ambassador Nancy Brinker, founder and CEO of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure Foundation, the great breast cancer group. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website, and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from one of my favorite groups, Les Unions, the French Jewish gypsy violin-based world music stars. It's called Hora Kakaval. My friends, may you be blessed with a good week and a week, we pray, of peace. ¶¶